Hi everyone, welcome to the Post Bougie podcast for the week of January 31st, 2010. This is Shawnee O in Central New Jersey, and today I'm joined by PB proprietor GD, who is in DC this week.
What's going on?
We also have Joel, who you know as Black Ink, and he's coming to us from Tampa, Florida.
What's up, people?
Sarita McFadden, a writer-photographer who's in Brooklyn, New York.
Hello, everyone.
And LaToya Peterson from LarissaLicious.com and Jezebel.com, who also joins us from the D.C. metro area.
Hello.
So we're going to talk about a few things today. First up is Barack Obama's State of the Union address. Second, we're going to talk about Chris Matthews' rather odd reaction to Obama's speech. And topic three is about a New York Times piece which notes that men are marrying women who are more educated than they are. And lastly, we'll close out with shout-outs to whatever awesomeness we've encountered recently. So we're going to just get started here. GD, Wednesday was Barack Obama's first State of the Union address. It's certainly received mixed reactions, but can you tell us a little bit more about what it all means?
It's actually hard to figure out what it all means, considering that Obama came into the State of the Union with a lot of pressure on him from the left and the right. The left was looking for tangible results. They felt that after a year in office, a lot of his pledges and his promises hadn't been accomplished, and the right had been, of course, accusing him of being too activist and expanding government too much. One of the big issues that was kind of looming over this was, again, healthcare reform. Healthcare reform seemed to be thrown into a tailspin after Scott Brown's election in Massachusetts. Democrats seemed to be distancing themselves from from the healthcare reform in general, and a lot of people were rightly, I think, upset that people were turning tail. And there was a few lines in the actual speech that seemed to be addressed to those people who were apparently looking for a way to not vote for the legislation, which is, again, very, very close to passing.
So, okay, because you all care, my take on it was that it was, you know, a solid speech, but I just don't care anymore what he has to say. Like, it was great, but I want to see things get done.
Precisely. I completely agree, Shani. Like, it's just, a speech is a speech. It's something, you get up, you perform it, you have time to prep it in advance, but what really is going to count is the results that come from the speech.
Ezra Klein did a whole list of like all the policy and the and speech, and it seemed like there was a lot, but I mean, how much of it is really going to happen? I'm kind of fatigued at this point from the speeches.
Well, it sounded like he was fatigued. I think he's, you know, the casualness and tone of his actual, like, you know, delivery of the of that speech almost suggested that, you know, he's exhausted by the whole structure or the whole structure of it being totally tied to running, like winning elections. I mean, all the policy that he's trying to get through for, you know, for better or worse, everything is mired in this constant detente between Republicans and Democrats and who's going to be in office every 2 years. It's exhausting.
Yeah, I think so. And I think, you know, shout out to Monica. She said this on Twitter last night. She said, Obama seems jaded about his own campaign slogan now. And I mean, that's kind of, you kind of get the sense that, like, there's really no playbook for how he came into the White House, you know? And so after a year of that, I kind of would expect him to sound a little bit beaten down and a little deflated and a little jaded about how things work, because I think nobody goes to D.C. to fail, you know? And although it's really early to say, you know, to judge his presidency with any sort of context, I mean, this first year has been really rough. I mean, but I think a lot of times we focus a lot on the failures and not necessarily on some of the successes. I'm not, you know, I don't want to be, you know, somebody accuse me of drinking the Kool-Aid, but I think it's like in college, you know what I mean? Like, when you come in as a freshman, you're nowhere near as mature as you'll be when you're a sophomore and you're a junior. And I guess it's, you know, the American people don't really have time, and they don't care about, you know, the learning curve and getting used to things and, you know, kind of, you know, feeling your way around. But I think that's kind of what this speech was. It's like, hey, I'm still the same guy. It's just, this is hard, you know?
So, okay, what about some of the policy that he was talking about? There was kind of, like, we were live blogging it and kind of incorporating all of our tweets on postbougie.com. And when he started talking about, like, nuclear power and clean coal, people were like, WTF. Like, what is going on with these kind of Republican concessions?
Mm-hmm. Yes, especially there was this whole session where he was like taking off all the tax cuts that he had instituted. It's kind of like, really? Like, he was really, really tacking hard to the right, or to the center at least.
No, I think he went right. He went center right. Clean coal is something that I still haven't been able to intellectually wrap my head around, or even just the mechanics of how that actually works in terms of, you know, actually securing the mineral in order to, and like, you know, and making it cleaner to be able to power or fuel anything. I don't really understand what that is. And knowing, you know, and the little bit that I understand about coal process, it's one of the dirtiest, maybe next to filthiest, you know, resources we harvest from, you know, the planet to like try and power anything. Is toxic.
Right. And then he was talking about offshore drilling, and it was like, what's really going on here?
Right. And I mean, one of the things that was the focus of the speech was moving us forward, right? I mean, moving us into being more competitive, taking it to the global marketplace, being a leader. All of these things are not possible if we're going to continue to work with fossil fuels and older, non-sustainable technology. It just doesn't work. Like, I was shocked that Green for All didn't send out a really angry email. You know, they sent out their generic stock, you know, here's Obama's speech and we need to take it forward into the 21st century. But, you know, his policies were very similar to the ones espoused by Sarah Palin when she was on the campaign trail. I was expecting him to say, like, dig, drill, baby, drill.
I was totally expecting him to say drill, baby, drill.
It was a complete about face from forward thinking in terms of energy policy, in terms of educating and retraining our populace to be competitive in the global marketplace. Environmental issues have this really wide-ranging effect, and so it was really strange to see him backtrack, particularly in that sector.
Well, is the problem that he's trying to be all things to all people, maybe? You know, is that...
Yeah, yeah.
Is that an element of that?
Yeah. I think he was definitely, though, trying to stem the bleeding, though. I mean, I think he had to... I don't know that there was a way for him to thread that needle, for him to get up there and list a bunch of liberal or progressive bullet points and say, this is what we need to do. I mean, I would have liked that to happen, but I think he really needed to kind of calm down a lot of people who are probably not a little bit nervous right now. I mean, and these are not people who are like who were never in his corner to begin with. You know, I think he needs to kind of win over a lot of the soft, independent middle. You know what I mean?
Right, but the soft, independent middle, it seems odd that they, you know, well, I don't know. I can't really, well, on one hand, I feel like I could speak to what that environmental policy that he was outlining has an effect on terms of what they were thinking. But I don't, like, it was a weird juxtaposition. I want to, like, we're going to invest in the infrastructure of building a high-speed rail service, like, you know, across the country, which is something, like, you know, infrastructure wise that I love, because it makes no sense that we're this society in this century, we don't have that available to us as, you know, some folks in, as folks in Europe, or even India for that matter. But at the same time, to stem whatever critique he would have gotten for, you know, infrastructure investment, he needed to go hard, well, not hard right, but right center with the environmental legislation, or just environmental concerns?
No, I don't think it makes sense that he did it. I mean, it doesn't make sense like from a policy standpoint, but I think it makes sense from like a rhetorical standpoint.
The independents that elected him into office, it wasn't like it was a super close race with McCain. People who elected him into office kind of did so overwhelmingly on this promise that things would change. And I feel like a lot of the change that Obama's trying to focus on is reforming Washington culture, trying to make people play together nicely, making sure that his public image is one of somebody that's accessible and bipartisan. And that's not really what we elected him for. We elected him because we needed a complete change and a break from the past 8 years of terrible foreign policy and terrible domestic policy.
But do you think that, I wonder how much of that is really, I wonder how much of the idea that he's this like post-partisan guy who gets up there and tries to make everyone play nice isn't so much just a public stance. I don't, like, you know what I mean? I don't think that, that it actually is.
But it's a waste of, it's a waste of time, though, because.
But I don't think he can't. Like, I don't think he can.
But if you look at, like, the response that Bob McDonald from Virginia gave to his speech, it was like he hadn't even watched the speech. Like, he had written it before, like.
But it doesn't.
But, I mean, he was addressing things, like, he was complaining about things that Obama addressed in the speech.
But it doesn't matter that they're not playing ball. It doesn't matter that they're not playing ball. The point is that he has to strike that pose. And whether or not that's a substantial pose, whether or not that pose is a real thing, is, I think, a pretty debatable point. But, I mean, and I understand Latoya's frustration. Like, it is annoying to seem as if he is making all these kind of concessions to the right. But I don't know that, in reality, that pose is a bad thing for him to have.
All right, like, so you're arguing perception of him having, of being, you know, holding the center is more important than the actual, you know, implementation of any policy.
The policy initiatives that he laid out last night were a little bit jarring. Like, they, like you said, like everyone said, they're kind of, they're crazy. I mean, offshore drilling is unsustainable. Even if we did it, we still wouldn't recover enough oil to make it, like, to make, put a dent, like, sooner or later we'd have to move away from fossil fuels in general. So, I mean, it's a joke, and this is the thing that Republicans never say, is that, like, they're, because they are so closely wed to the oil industry, they kind of have to say that, but it's not an answer to our problems. And I may be misremembering this, but it seemed as if he was, the way he worded it was actually very vague.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He said something like, we need to make hard decisions on issues like offshore drilling or something like that, which is not
vague. I mean, he was vague on progressive policy too. Like, don't ask, don't tell. He just said, we need to work toward, you know, what does that even mean?
What he's doing is actively not only alienating his base that came out from in large numbers, you know, particularly with the minority vote and the youth vote, both of which are very fickle voting categories. I mean, that's what it is with polling. Like, it's, you know, minority votes, youth votes. It's a really fickle thing.
Right.
And it must be able to be counted upon in 2012. And so he needs to start acting like it's going to be one term. What people are responding to isn't necessarily facts or compromise, but very strong stances.
I mean, the interview that he did with Diane Sawyer this week, where he basically says that he'd rather be a really good one-term president than a mediocre 8-year president, which is a really strange thing coming from him in, you know, in the anniversary of his first year. That this is kind of the tack that he's playing.
Well, it's kind of like the, I'd rather be unpopular and effective than popular. And
how many examples of that do we have, though?
Right. And I'm not sure.
I mean, that's just something to say. I mean, that's
right. Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? I mean, I don't think anybody really, like, well, man, I don't care if I don't get elected, you know, in 2000. I mean, I don't think anybody really thought he believed that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think it was just like one of those, like, you know, one of those, I'm a humble guy who just wants to do my job well. I mean, yeah. I think, like you said, to go back to
last thought.
Okay, so I mean, I actually wanted to ask a question, though. I want to know.
He has more to say later, Joel.
No, I want to ask which
saving recommendation
would kind of buy Obama time in your eyes. Like, I mean, I feel like DADT will go. I mean, repealing DADT, don't ask, don't tell. Sorry, will go a long way to kind of to winning back a lot of disaffected liberals and progressives over. But I'm not sure what you guys, if there are other issues you think that Obama needs to be, I mean, besides healthcare, obviously, but I wonder if there are other issues that you think Obama could be more proactive about really, really stumping for.
I mean, closing Guantanamo would be nice. I understand that it took them a lot longer to get just the paperwork that they needed than they anticipated, but that would be a huge thing.
Right. And if he's publicizing things like, or if he's passing things like the Recovery Act, and they're benefiting people. We need to be hearing that all over the place.
Exactly.
We need to be hearing that. What's the Recovery Act doing for me? What's the jobs bill?
Exactly. Yeah.
What's the website?
The jobs bill, especially.
Right. What's the website that tracks the stimulus, though?
It's recovery.gov.
Is that?
Yeah, I think it's recovery.gov.
Okay.
All right. Okay, well,
yeah, right.
We need to move on. Anyway, this is a very stimulating discussion. We're going to slide right into our next topic, which is totally related, and it's about Chris Matthews' remark on Barack Obama's speech. And I'm going to play a clip here, and then Joel will talk a little bit about it.
I was trying to think about who he was tonight, and it's interesting. He is post-racial, by all appearances. You know, I forgot he was black tonight for an hour. You know, he's gone a long way to become a leader of this country and passed so much history in just a year or two. I mean, it's something we don't even think about. I was watching, I said, wait a minute, he's an African-American guy in front of a bunch of other white people, and there he is, President of the United States, and we've completely forgotten that tonight. Completely forgotten it.
I think this is really interesting because, like, right as the State of the Union started, I'd had it on MSNBC, and, like, I tweeted this. I was like, why am I subjecting myself to Chris Matthews' commentary? And then, like, you know, like an hour later, you know, if I had turned, I would have missed that. And, you know, and I would have picked that with it. And I think, you know, Ta-Nehisi wrote, like, a great, dude is a beast, but... You know, he made a really good point in a post about this today that, you know, it's important to note that Chris Matthews was not trying to take a shot at anybody. He was not trying to be offensive. He was not trying to hurt anybody. And even he came back today and kind of rolled that back and said where, you know, he tried to explain that comment by saying, you know, I just wanted to say, you know, that there was an absence of racial tension in the speech that night, you know, when, and I mean, whatever, right? You know, for whatever it's worth. I mean, Chris Matthews is prone to saying dumb things.
Yes.
You know, if it's like, you know, if it's a thrill up his leg, it's something else. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, just question. So, when is it prone to saying dumb things, and when is it you have a career of saying sexist and racist things on the air, and you still have a job? When is the line get crossed? That's all I want to know. When is that?
This
line
is the same network. This is the same network that employs Pat Buchanan.
I know.
I mean, it would be a lot easier if there weren't so many women and minorities running around. Then Chris Matthews wouldn't have to worry about anything.
Right, and there used to not be.
That's why he still has a job.
He just have an issue with. Justin. But that doesn't make it okay.
Look, all right, but to defend Chris Matthews for like 2 seconds,
uh-huh.
He was so golly gee about it, though. Did you see the golly geeness in his eyes?
Post-racial America. I forgot he was a Negro. Like, no.
He got hit by the neck, Magic Negro's wand. You know what I mean? Like, he was he casted a jungle spell over him.
I think you mean the Serengeti. Come on.
Yeah, right. Oh, yeah.
But no, I thought Ta-Nehisi's response saying, you know, a person like Chris Matthews, a white person who thinks that, you know, not being, like, thinks that being articulate is not being black or is something separate from that, needs to really interrogate their own thoughts on the subject.
Right. What he said was that they interpret your articulateness as a... Like, oh, good for you, you know, good for you that you can speak eloquently or whatever, as opposed to like an indictment of their beginning assertion that black people can't be these things. I mean, the problem with the whole post-racial thing is that it starts, like, it begins with a premise that whiteness is still the default, right? Like, it's still the starting place. So, like, if Obama isn't raced, you know, or if someone isn't gendered, then they're male, right? If he's not raced, then he's white. You know what I mean? Like, Obama's blackness was the thing that was eradicated. It wasn't like the whiteness of the people in the room that was eliminated or neutralized. You know what I mean?
Right. Although, of course, Ta-Nehisi was like, Chris Matthews forgot he was white, not that Obama was black.
Right, absolutely.
And my favorite line, one of my favorite lines, there were a lot of really good ones in his piece, it was that that Obama is black and brilliant is pleasant but unsurprising to me. I've known very brilliant black people, very black people all my life. At some point, that number of white people who still can't get their heads around our humanity will have to accept the truth. The president's black, even if you don't quite know what that means. I thought that was deep. Yep. I'm like snapping right now and drinking tea.
Herbal tea?
Yeah, no.
No. Oh God.
I didn't see Chris Matthews' response, so like I don't know if he was defensive as he's explaining this. And I you know, that, I guess the thing, we have to give people the space to learn. You know what I mean? Like we have to give people. We can't. I'm not right. mad at Chris Matthews. I want him to explain himself and then like, hey man, this is why this is stupid. You know what I mean? So. I don't know what, you know, getting mad and calling him, you know, dumb and calling him a racist. I don't know what that really accomplishes because I do think he was coming from a good place. It's just that it was a wrong place, you know?
I'm curious as to what LaToya has to say about that.
For Chris Matthews, okay.
Yeah.
There's more at play than just one person's internalized bias.
Right.
He helps to shape the media. He's part of the media landscape. He helps to shape people's opinions. And what happens in these kind of scenarios isn't that suddenly Chris Matthews reflects and goes, oh, you know, why did I say Barack mm-hmm. wasn't black anymore? Why, you know, what does this mean? Mm-hmm. About, oh, that's not what I meant at all. I meant he seems like a great guy. And then you get inundated with these letters. Oh, I didn't think that was racist either. I know exactly what you meant. And it gets solved, okay? Now you laugh, but that's just what happens. Every time, like...
Yeah, because everyone gets to be the objective arbiter. Of what racist is and what racist mm-hmm. isn't. Like, I didn't think it was racist, so it's not racist. I didn't personally take offense to it, so it's not racist.
Like, there's, you know, like, when you talk about, like, racism, particularly racism in media, I notice there's two different distinct types of people. There are the people who are clueless and racist. They just don't have any idea. They weren't around black people. They have no clue. Sometimes they're open to listening, sometimes they're not, but they're racist and clueless. And then I notice there are the people who are kind of endorsing the racism. They're not clueless. They know it's racist, but they don't want to say anything about it. Oh, you know, he's old. Don't worry about it. This man is reporting on policy in the State of the Union. He's got a platform. What do you mean we're not going to call him out on this? This is ridiculous. But this is where we are with our racial conversation. No one gets hurt. No one's feelings get hurt. But at the same time, we remain in this deadlock.
It would be amazing to have TNC and Chris Matthews kind of have an openish dialogue that really kind of examines the flaw in what he's in his word choice.
But that would require, I think, like a proximity to a lot of people of color, right? I mean, you would just have to be in a place where you would be starting from the position that people of color are not a monolith, and that, you know, like you'd have right. to have to have a lot of personal relationships with people of color, and I think that's really easy for people not to have.
Yeah, there's that, but then there's also the idea that somebody has to really be willing to listen to and receive a message before they can hear it. So, you know, let's say you do get Ta-Nehisi and Chris Matthews in a room together. If Chris Matthews is of the mindset that being a racist means that you actively hate black people.
Right.
And he's like, I don't hate black people. I'm fine with black people. I have black friends.
right.
Not, you know, you laugh at it because it's funny, but at the same time, you hear it so often. Yeah, I mean, Scott Baio was doing that mess. You know, he even went with, my wife has a black
friend. My wife has a black friend. <That's right. laughs>
Let him in my house and use my restroom.
But if he's sitting there and going, I can't be racist because no matter what Ta-Nehisi is saying, it's not going to make it through. He's so convinced he cannot be racist, it won't even enter his mind that what he did or said in some way was wrong or offensive. There's this impulse to kind of mollify people who have done or said something racist so they don't feel like they're bad people. Right. And I feel like the racial dialogue in the United States is really around enforcing white guilt. Kind of like, you know, you have to feel bad because of X, Y, Z. And so in some way, instead of going, oh, I need to understand history a little bit better, and figure out why people are saying that there's a legacy from slavery and that there's a legacy from Jim Crow and that there's all these issues that didn't get solved in the last 40 years. A lot of people internalize that as racists are bad people. Mm-hmm. I am not a bad person. Therefore, I can't be called racist. Right. And I mean, like, you see this come up time and time again.
All right. More on race. Woo, more race. Okay, so a Pew Research poll from a few weeks ago indicated that men are more frequently marrying women who are better educated, make more money than they do. But the New York Times picked up the story. But in a bizarre twist, the reporter, Sam Roberts, still somehow managed to make the piece about how educated women simply can't find men. Enter our very own special guest, Sarita, who was quoted in the article as saying... I haven't even said the quote yet. Okay. With men of any ethnic group, it's a little intimidating for them to encounter smart women. Money is tricky. But I think for me, it comes down to compatibility. Can you grow with me? Or as my genius friend, the textile designer, says, she asks on first dates or meeting men in bars, do you have a passport and a library card? Sarita. Okay.
You know, tone is so lost sometimes on the internet. And the interwebs.
Explain yourself, because there was a really kind of hilarious, very snarky post the New York Magazine about this.
I know.
They were so mean.
Well, one of the things, it was kind of a running joke that we had, you know, amongst many of, like, you know, some of my friends who are out there who are, you know, doing a single ladies dance, but not necessarily, you know, not necessarily with the intent of getting married or being partnered up, but just, like, you know, dating and being, you know, independent and, enjoying themselves. You know, my friend who's textile designer and writer, her thing was, do you have a passport and a library card, and are you prepared to use them? You say it really tongue in cheek. And some guys are, like, looking at you crazy, and they kind of laugh, and then they answer or they don't. It wasn't necessarily meant to sound nearly as condescending as I think some of the really snarky posts took that to be. But right. But what was interesting to me about some of, you know, the snarky posts or the snarky response, and then some of the very fascinating emails I got afterward and from people who searched me on Google and found me on Facebook to tell me something about myself and dating and men of color. There are a few things. I really should have said some. I was not trying to generalize, because that is terrible. But also, one of the things that we do when we're out there meeting, you know, trying to, like, you know, connect with someone and date, is that we often get, like, caught up in certain tropes. You don't necessarily ask other questions outside of the comfort zone box of, what do you do? Where do you live? I mean, New York conversation is so much about what neighborhood you live in and why, and how much you pay for wherever you live, and that says something about you too. You know, one of the reasons why it was such an interesting little primer is to try and get to break out of the paradigm of, like, I want to know where you went to school, like a laundry list of all of these things that say this is who you are, rather than, you know, what do you like? I mean, if you're going to spend time with someone, it'd be good to, like, you know, get a sense of what kind of person they are, rather than just blah, blah, blah. I work for this investment bank firm, or blah, blah, blah. I work for this company and I have this title, and this title says that I'm this kind of person. It doesn't. Mm-hmm. It's just banal. Well, like, men are visual creatures. They see, you know, they're visually stimulated. They see something beautiful and sparkly in a bar, and they manage to focus on certain parts.
Oh, which you're not trying to generalize, right?
Yeah, right.
Oh, wait. GD, did I generalize? Right now.
Well, I wanted to say, though, I think, and I kind of mentioned this to LaSoya a little bit earlier, but I feel like there are all these things we hold up as, like, talismans, as symbol that symbolize other things about people. And for a lot of people, those are, you know, degrees or, you know, these things that supposedly tell us, like, the kind of person that someone is. But I think the same could be true, same could be said of, like, library cards or passports, you know, or any of those things. Like, people who say, you're not really a gentleman if you don't hold open a door, as if, like...
I don't think that's the same thing at all, though, because...
Really? Yeah. I don't own a library card. No. I read all the damn time.
Wait. Like, I actually don't own a library card either, and yes, I read all the damn time, too.
Right, absolutely.
However, like...
I didn't mean it literally.
But if you, like...
Well, no, I know you didn't mean it. You're like, let me see your library card. Is it stamped? Let me see how many, you know what I mean?
Right. But if you have... No, listen. If you have that like iBanker job or whatever, all that tells me is that you work all the time and you're probably boring as hell. Now, if you have a passport or you read books, that's a little bit more interesting.
No, it's more interesting because you think that's interesting, because those are the things that you value in a partner. But like,
so
they're still,
what's
they're still
wrong with
just,
asking about that?
No, well, I mean, because none of those questions give you the answer that you want. Like, someone could read all the time and not necessarily be thoughtful or insightful or have anything interesting to say about those books or understand the books they're reading. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, these are all things, and there's no realistic way to know everybody you go out on a date with, like. Without, I mean, you have to ask these questions. The problem is that they all are imperfect in telling you what you want to know about someone. You know what I mean?
Like, I'm not expecting a guy to list the books he's read. I'm like, and he'll tell me a book he read, and if he had like, and I was like, oh, I've never read that. And then you find out if A, they're thoughtful, B, you'll find out if they're insightful, and C, you'll find out if whether or not like you'll discover something. I mean, you know, it's a way in. It's not, you know, it's not a list.
It's not the indicator of whether or not they're the right person for you, but it gives you more insight into who they are than what their job is.
Exactly.
Depending on what their job is.
It's just another conversation point, essentially, then. Yeah.
Well, it is. I also feel like a big part of these conversations we have around race and dating are totally framed as a setup. Anyway, no matter what, somebody's getting dragged through the mud, and like, you know, sometimes you get like those masterful, like I think there was a hit job on ABC that got black women and black men, just like one big fell swoop.
Was that the Steve Harvey?
That was the one with
Steve Harvey.
Harvey
the expert?
Yeah,
So I do feel like that, because dating is such a subjective thing. Now, there are other outside influences on it, like race, like gender, like our positionings in society. Like, there's a huge thread going right now on racial issues about the non-Asian ideal of masculinity and discussions. And, it went into being a dating discussion. Like, we can't talk about
masculinity without sex.
Yeah, you can't talk about gender without talking about sex.
Yeah, it just doesn't work. Everything goes back to sex and who's screwing who. But one of the things that, again, that you fail to realize is that, one, people try to generalize a lot based on dating habits. So, like, when it comes to, like, your piece, Sarita, or Helena Andrews' piece, which she got a lot of infamy for. Or even the piece that that CVT wrote for our site. There are all these people trying to say, well, what's wrong with you is.
Right.
All you have to do is.
All you have to do is. And it doesn't work that way. For a lot of people, there are a lot of different things that make them tick. For some people, as messed up as it may be, they want a partner that makes a lot of money and that makes more money to them, and that is what they need to make a relationship work. For other people, it doesn't matter if their partner had never gone to college or never even seen a textbook, as long as they're a good person and they can take care of, like, autistic children. Who knows? You form what you're looking for based on a lot of complicated factors that work for you individually.
Absolutely.
And I feel like a lot of the issues come from trying to use some one-size-fits-all method, like, you know, Jimmy Israel's book, or like Chris book.
Right? He shall not be named.
Yeah,
Voldemort. It's Voldemort.
He's going to pop up. Like, none of us will hear the end of this.
Like, if you look at anybody who's writing a dating book that's like, what's wrong with X people? You can tell these are all stereotypes.
Absolutely.
Realizations. And generally, you know, you shouldn't, this is my personal opinion from having read 100 and some dating books for various work reasons. What I've learned from reading all those books is that you should only follow dating advice from somebody that you would want to date yourself or has dated somebody you want to date. Therefore, if you want to date
Steve Harvey.
Their books, because they are telling you from their experience what works for them. If you want to have a relationship with Ja Rule and probably be treated badly, read Chris Stein's book. You know,
he would sing to you. He would rap sing to you all the time.
He would rap sing to you while he's, you know, bending you over a chair. Whatever. You just don't want to know, man.
No, I don't want to know. Yeah, don't make that make
things
sense.
I do for my job, yo. I read the Vixen Manual.
Whoa, wait, we're talking
about
yeah, basically. It's up on Jezebel if you want to look at her like diagrams and everything. But
this is Corinne
Steffen's book, The Vixen Manual, which tells you how to get a man. Diagrams, dude. It's on Jezebel.
Wow.
Diagrams?
diagrams to make sure that you don't have a worn out VJJ.
Oh.
Wow.
Sweet and I are like,
what is this? What is this dark that
you speak of? I just recoiled in horror from my computer.
Right, can we pivot back to the actual study?
Yeah. Okay. Oh,
does the study itself surprise anybody? The study about the fact that more women
and that was the thing, was that men have been marrying women who are well educated for decades, centuries. Like, it's not like it, not, you know, not in general, but it, I mean, the numbers increase, but you know, you had women who were better educated than their husband, because he was, you know, going off to work after high school and she was in college.
I mean, I think that's probably depends on where you live, you know. I mean,
well, no, that's true. Well, I'm thinking about Little House on the Prairie right now, but
well, I mean, okay. I mean, if you look at the median incomes in the country, men have outearned women for the entire history of the country. So this is like kind of
right, but that's not reliant on education necessarily.
Well, I mean, but education usually
equates to.
Right. Et cetera. Not that, I mean, obviously there's exceptions to the rules, but as a general rule, you know, I mean, anyway, but I thought what was fascinating about, I mean, we know for a long time, especially among Black people, that there's this huge disparity in the number of women who graduate from college, who go to college and graduate and get postgraduate degrees and all that other stuff, versus the number of men. So if we're assuming that, and that's true across the board, Black or not, is especially pronounced for Black people. So it's not surprising to me that there are just, the dating pool is probably there for women who are really educated is probably very, very small if they're looking for men who are
of
small.
Equal education. Yeah,
you're right.
But
if
also,
they're looking for something specific, right?
The amount
right.
of, like, people are getting married less than they were before, also.
Which I think is much more of a conversation rather than, like, you know, how educated, you know, the general population's become in terms of who's who's eligible. I think it's much more interesting to me that, you know, everyone's attitude about marriage is starting to shift or has shifted in some kind of way.
Marriage trends adjust with society. So back in the 70s, yeah, maybe more people were getting married, but you could also maintain household on a lot less, which I think was brought up in the Pew study. You can also maintain a household on a lot less. You could do it on one person's income. And a lot of things that we consider standard, like air conditioning and such, were not so then. So it wasn't as expensive to raise children. And when things start getting more expensive, when wages are stagnant, people wait longer to have an adult, you know, I'm putting adult in quotes here, but have an adult relationship, to move into the adult world, to have a serious relationship that would lead to marriage, to start a family, because we just simply can't afford it. So I feel like that's also a huge influence that also kind of gets swept a bit under the rug in the whole, oh my God, women are so educated, they're not going to get married anymore thing. I think most women, I think one of the statistics I was reading, most women have been married by the time they are 40 years old. It doesn't mean they necessarily stayed together. But when you talk about marriage and discussions of who is single and who is not, the term of never married and, you know, married but divorced or widowed, those are two completely different statistics that are often conflated.
Right. Yeah. It's also important to note that that women who, or people who are more educated, also are less likely to divorce. There are a lot of reasons why they might be that you could speculate about, but, I mean, the statistics also bear out that the more education you have, the less likely you are to end your marriage.
All right. We're going to wrap this one up, too. And lastly, as usual, we're going to go around and do shout-outs to whatever we think is cool this week. Joel, do you want to start?
Yeah, I guess so. I really don't. I really didn't have anything until I had dinner tonight, and so I guess it's like my recommendation or my shout out is like just putting curry and shit, man. Like I had some mulligatawny soup tonight for the first time in my life, you know. And I mean, it was really good. I guess as I've gotten older, I've gotten more into having curry or whatever, because I went, you know, my thing was, I always said I went to New York, and I know you folks are going to hate me, but I say every time I go to New York, I've never had a good meal.
This is my southern insecurity.
So, but you know, I'm willing to admit that up front. You know what I'm saying? But yeah, I mean, and I'd had Indian food. Like, I get, where's, you guys would know this, like the row of restaurants where there's like a lot of Indian restaurants on this one street. Sixth, where is that?
Sixth Street.
Word. Between, okay.
Between first and second.
Right. And I had a meal there.
You don't know. You're just saying right.
Yeah, well, no, I mean, I guess that's what it was, right? You know what I'm saying? And, you know, homeboy had the sitar, and it was, you know, it was good. I was like, all right, I'm about to do the authentic thing, and I just didn't get into it. But for whatever reason, you know, here I am, you know, 7 years later, and I was getting down on some mulligatawny, so. And also, let me recommend, and I posted this earlier this week, D'Angelo's Voodoo. It was the 10-year anniversary this week. And I know Shani just like, I mean, she didn't know who Peyton Manning was last week, and she does not care about who D'Angelo is.
But I know who D'Angelo is.
I know you know who he is. I'm saying you don't care, though.
This is true.
Yeah, I just,
that's yeah. Seriously, it's hard to like mount a really like a zealous enough defense for that album. I think Voodoo was like one of the best albums of the last 15 years. It is a fantastic album all the way through.
Yeah,
I mean, I think it's like. Yeah, the only two albums of the Neo Soul, I don't even know if you count it as Neo Soul, but the only two albums, that whole movement, the only two masterpieces, the classics that came out of that movement were Mama's Gun and Voodoo. Those are the only two.
Word.
Yeah.
Yeah. I can agree to that. Those, and they both came out in the same year, in 2000.
Yep, so. Absolutely. Well, yeah. I think they're flawless albums.
I can get behind Mama's Gun. All right. Okay, LaToya, what you got for us?
Wow. Y'all going to have to give me some warning when you're...
That's your endorsement endorsing warning.
Yeah. Two of my jobs require me hating on things.
No, but now you have to talk about something good.
So it takes me a while. I gotta remember. So, no, here was a cool thing that happened. So on Monday, I was sitting down and I was watching MTV's True Life because I'm completely addicted to that show. I don't know why. I watch all the episodes. Don't ask me why, I just do. And it was True Life. I'm addicted to video games, right?
All
right. So I'm like, okay, here we go. What are we going to see? Not only did they have a girl, they had a black girl. Now they have a black girl. They had a black girl in a relationship. Now they have a black girl in a relationship. They had a black girl in a relationship who managed to get straight A's, keep her boyfriend, and keep gaming all at the same time.
Hey, go ahead.
That's your story. You're telling the story right now.
Throw your hands up at me.
Yes.
See what? All the single gamers.
Single gamers. All the coupled gamers.
The coupled gamers. But yeah, it was great. It was great. And it was good to see that representation on TV, even though people don't really believe us. Like, I'm like, yeah, I know other girls are game, and they're like, whatever, you lying. That's okay, though. It's great to have that kind of representation on a major network like MTV, and that MTV continually does show gamers that don't necessarily fit that the ideal prototype for the industry, which is a white male technophile age 15 to 30.
GD, what's your shout out?
I wanted to bite Joel and recommend something involving food as well. This is a blog called Fed Up with School Lunch. This is this anonymous teacher in the Midwest. I'm not sure which state she's in, but she's from the Midwest. She's an anonymous teacher. And every day she decided if she's going to blog about the food that the kids had to eat in the cafeteria. So she every day she eats the food with them, and she blogs about it. And so far, she's been sick a bunch of times, and she hates all the food that they give her. Sometimes she's like, "Oh,
ew, I just pulled it up. Look at that chicken patty.
Yeah, I'm looking at it. Yeah.
Like, do they still make mock chicken leg?
Remember Ribby Cube? I don't know if you had those on the way up.
Do they eat chicken a la king outside of school cafeterias? Like, does chicken a la king still exist anymore? Do people eat that?
Not after 1955, no.
Wow. Take that. But no, it's like, I'm curious, because in high school, we didn't even have school lunch. We had... No, seriously, they had a contract with McDonald's and... Domino's Pizza, and so they would just they would buy like chicken nuggets in bulk, and of course they just like bought it from the McDonald's down the street, so it was like cold by the time I got there. And they would just, you went and you paid like, you know, $2 for whatever, you know, so of course you couldn't like get it customized. You could be like, I don't want pickles on my sandwich, like, you know, you just had to get it as you got it.
Dang.
I don't even remember. I haven't had the school lunch experience since like middle school, and but yo, like, especially considering that article that I think, I don't know if it was me or Jamel, one of us blogged about this a couple months ago about how there was this study had done that said like the meat that went into the school lunch was like less safe than the meat that went to like to all the fast food chains.
Yeah, that's tested.
Yeah, that's foul. But yeah, I just wanted to shout out this lady for falling on the grenade for all of us and eating this nasty ass food.
Okay, Sarita, what you got for us?
I'm gonna recommend a beer because I love this beer. It's funny. I really should avoid beer for like certain kinds of health reasons, but I know, like, yeah, like, you know, like maybe I'm gluten intolerant, I don't know, but I love Old Speckled Hen.
I'm thirsty. Sarita, my boyfriend gave me props. He apparently loves your beer. There you go.
Thank you. Thank you.
You're the beer drinker of the household.
thank you, Latoya's man. Thank you. But I think it's an ale. It's an English ale. I've had it like, you know, I've been drinking it for like maybe the past like 12 months since the summer or whatever, because, you know, whatever, happy hour, and that's what you do on a Friday with your friends who still have jobs. But not like at a great bar somewhere in Williamsburg that has Wi-Fi, but Old Speckled Hen is pretty awesome. It's smooth. It's delicious.
Old, I swear to God, I'm going to laugh every time you say it.
What, Old Speckled Hen?
All right. Well, now I know what we're drinking when I come to Brooklyn.
Yes. I'm going to check it out. Like, I bought my friend. I have a friend, and I bought him Arrogant Bastard Ale.
Yes.
It fit his personality, but he actually really likes that beer. So it worked out all around. I'm not afraid of something called Spotted Head or Speckled Head or whatever. We'll try that.
All right. One, there is no – the Speckled Hen is not – there's no logo.
Oh, actually. Hen. You said hen.
Oh, you thought you said head, didn't you?
I just said
head.
<logo. laughs> <Yeah. laughs> I was like, oh, I love God. Old Speckled Hen. I'm like, ew. Wow.
Hen, I've been like a chicken.
Yes.
A hen.
Female chicken.
Oh, see, oh. That now.
I'm like, why is it giggling?
Okay. Five. That's why.
Okay. Anyway, the beer is delicious. It has its special glass. I highly recommend it.
Okay. My shout out. I had trouble picking a shout out this week because I haven't really done anything but read this week. But I've been like reading a lot of books that I would be embarrassed to tell you that I've been reading because they're books that my mother has been mailing me from like my childhood. My parents are in California, I'm in New Jersey. And so there's probably like 200 books of mine in the garage. And so my mom has been mailing me a box every week. And so, yes, I was up till after midnight last night reading a terrible teen romance novel.
Which one?
I refuse because you've never heard of it. It's part of like a romance series. And so,
will we have heard of the series?
Is it Choose Your Own Adventure?
No. It's like the series is called like First Love from Silhouette.
Oh, Jesus.
I know, exactly. But in addition to that, so I've been reading, it's been kind of an interesting exploration because they're the books that I was completely obsessed with when I was like 13, and I'm reading them now and I'm like, this was terrible. What was I thinking? And then there are books that I loved and I still love. And so my shout out, I guess, this week is to Lucy Maud Montgomery she's Canadian, and she wrote the Anne of Green Gables series. And I don't know if anybody here has read that. Probably not. But
Okay.
Yay. Okay.
Right. So, I got your back.
So I love the Anne series, and I still do. So I'm glad that they've held up well from 1914 when they were released or whatever, until to today. And that's my shout out this week. So that'll do it for this week's podcast. Oh. And
What? Yeah, I said, dope. All right. Yeah, I'm sorry. You know,
somebody... Yeah, I mean, you can stick around, Joel. Yeah. So on behalf of GD, Joel, Sarita, LaToya, this is Shawnee, and I'd like to thank you all for listening. Catch you next time.
Our theme music is 8 by Aeon. You can catch us at postfuji.com.